And it was nice being here. My name is Jim Beam, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, the desire of my own most of the time, people like you, meetings like this, a damn good sponsor. I haven't had a drink since January the 18th of 1971. But I'm grateful. Is this some kind of a hog calling tent? You were right. Karen comes out to our meetings in West Los Angeles. Young lady sitting up here in the front row, and she's been telling me for months about your enthusiasm. Thank you. This is delightful. I'm delighted to be here. I'm not as good as I look. In 18 years, I've been to a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and a lot of conferences and conventions and roundups, and speakers always look good. And I just want to tell you that I'm a carpenter, that I'm not wearing this suit to impress you. I don't have any T-bills sticking out of my pocket. I don't have a new car in the driveway. My bank balance is about $312 before I went to the money machine this morning. If you're new and you're sitting out there looking at this deal, I'm just an alcoholic. I'm just a drunk that found a way of life in people like you that gave me a life that was immeasurable. It gave me a life that was wondrous and sometimes painful, but a way to go through it. I'm just a drunk with a funny name who's delighted to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of the front row guys. I love AA. I love everything about it. I love the conferences and the little round table discussion meetings. I love the one-on-ones and the coffee shops and the babies and the sponsors and the traditions and the service and everything about this deal. Because I wouldn't be alive. If I were alive, I would be pitiful and incomprehensibly demoralized, dying by inches out there on the street. And here I stand in front of you guys, and you sat in front of me free from the bondage of self and hundreds of other diseases that kept us captive. God, that feels good. And I'm glad to be a part of this thing. This thing we call Alcoholics Anonymous. This thing is the most unusual club in the world. The most powerful club in the world. What other club has as many meetings as we have? How many other organizations would you sit in every night in a hard chair in a smoke-filled room and drink rotten coffee for the rest of your life and laugh your way back to sanity? This is the only club in the world that wants bad people in its club. In fact, the worse you are, the more we want you in here. Kiwanis don't want bad people in their club. The Elks and the Jaycees, the Moose. Only AA. In fact, the worse you are, the more you get asked to talk. We want us to lead you. You would lead us. I have to share with you what I was like. I was a sissy. I'm a wuss. I'm not macho. I don't have a hair on my chest or a tattoo. I don't smoke cigars. Can't grow a beard. My sponsor won't let me. Look like I got the mange if I try one. Anyway. I grew up a wimp. I was raised by my mother primarily because my dad was a drunk and he was gone a lot. And I love Mom, and she and I spent a lot of time together, and I learned how to do Mom things, I guess. I learned how to cook and clean and bake and do stuff. I love sitting in that old yellow kitchen, sitting on the floor, watching biscuits rise through the window of that oven. That's high part of my day, you know. I went to school and I didn't raise no steer, and I never made varsity anything. I went to glee club and camera club and stuff like that. I'd have been at home ec, but they wouldn't let me in the old days. I was just a wimp. But you know what? I never felt different. I've heard a lot of speakers come up to these microphones and talk about feeling different all their lives. And I didn't. I had other little wimp friends that I ran around with. Stuff raised on a farm in a small town in Central California, Southern San Joaquin Valley, was fine. There was nothing wrong at all. I had a good time. I had good friends. I loved them. I had a great relationship with my mother and stayed away from my dad because he was unpredictable. He was a cop and a drunken cop. And everything was okay so far as I knew. And I grew up through the early years of high school, and I got drunk in high school. One of them house parties, somebody's parents leave town for the weekend, and I went to this deal with my big brother, and I got drunk at that party. First time. I had a few sips of mom's beer along the way, I suppose, but that party, I went in there weighing 118 pounds. I was about 6 feet tall. They called me Slim or Stick or Skinny, stuff like that. I had goofy hair and freckles, a squeaky voice. I mean, I was really a wallflower, and that's where I got. I got in the corner of that living room and stuck myself to the wallpaper, and somebody handed me a beer, and I drank that. Somebody gave me another one, and I drank that, and I went and got another one, I suppose. I stood in the corner of that living room, and somebody handed me a screwdriver or something like that, I suppose, a long time ago. And I started drinking that, and all of a sudden, I began to gain weight. I stood in that corner drinking various things until I got up to about 175 pounds. And my voice dropped down an octave. My hair started laying down real nice and getting kind of wavy. My complexion darkened. I could feel my mustache starting to grow. And I walked out in the middle of the room and asked this skinny girl to dance. And she said, sure. And I didn't know how to dance. I'd never danced with anybody. But she stood up, and I taught myself how to dance in about 3 minutes. I did what the other kids did, you know, mimic them. I had a good time. For the very first time in my life, I felt like they looked. And I got out there and I danced to hit tunes of the time. Got a slow dance going there, and I got that girl up next to me, and I could smell her perfume and feel her body up next to mine, and I wanted what she had. Willing to go to any length to get it. Well, you're a sick bunch, aren't you? You know what? I just realized something. This is Thursday night. If there's this many people unemployed in Omaha... Anyway, I went out in the kitchen, get another drink, and all the guys, the macho dudes from school, the football players, my big brother, the guys who were smoking, already had a tattoo. You know, the tough guys were all out in the kitchen, passing a bottle around. And I walked out there, and the captain of the football team put his arm around my shoulder and pulled me up into that circle of the guy. Almost wet my pants. This guy said, how you doing, kid? And I squeaked something, fine, you know, whatever. And they told jokes, and I laughed at their jokes. Got my drink, and I went back out in the living room, started giving dancing lessons to people. And I just had a wonderful time. Wonderful time. For about an hour, or maybe an hour and a half, I had the best time I ever had while drinking in my entire drinking career, I believe. Because I went out there and I could talk to those girls and I could dance and I could talk to the guys and I learned how to smoke a cigarette that night. And I had it all. I felt wonderful. I felt whole and complete and tough and macho and suave and debonair and sophisticated. And whatever I wanted to be, I could be it. And I danced and I laughed and I cut up and I had a great time. And if I hadn't begun to puke, it would have been a perfect evening. See, I didn't know I was going to this drinking party. And that afternoon, I had baked this big sheet of cookies with my secret recipe. Brownies, it was. And we had a big dinner, as farm families do. And then I ate about a half a dozen of these brownies, and then I went to a drinking party. And as the evening manifested itself, and I found out what booze could do, I wanted more. And I drank anything that was unattended that night. I mean, I drank your drink. Cigarette butts and all. I liked what I had found. I turned around to say something to somebody, and I puked a vile-smelling green slime. And they cleaned that up, and the next thing I knew, I was out in the backyard, laying flat on my back on the grass, puking straight up. And all these kids were out there laughing at me. All these little girls. The football team, they had this big circle around me. And my big brother had the garden hose on me, trying to clean me up and sober me up. And I was humiliated and embarrassed and degraded. It was awful. But the problem that would bring me to Omaha tonight didn't start that night. The problem that brought me here today began a couple of days later when I felt different. When I got back to school and I realized I was terrified of the captain of the football team and all of those cool dudes. The problem was I saw Barb coming down the hallway who had been at that, and I ducked into the boys' room in case so she wouldn't even speak to me. She wouldn't even say hi because I knew my voice would squeak and break, and I'd break out in a sweat, and I would embarrass myself in front of this little cutie. For the next 15 years, I didn't set out to do the horrible, embarrassing, humiliating, perverted, illegal, twisted, perverted things that I did. All I wanted to do was recapture that hour and a half when there was no fear, that hour and a half when I was complete, that hour and a half when I felt like they looked, that hour and a half when I could laugh and have fun, that hour and a half when it was all okay. That's all I set out to do. I didn't set out to malign and molest and hurt and rape and steal and connive and shoot people down. I didn't set out to fail and never become a man. I didn't set out to embarrass and humiliate my family and my kids and my employers and my friends. I didn't set out to do any of the terrible things that I did. All I wanted to do was find that hour when there was no sharp edges, when it was fun, when it was camaraderie and laughter and joy and lovemaking and fast cars and excitement, or when it was sadness, you know? You know that kind of drinking where you get just the right amount of booze in you and you turn the lights down real low and you're alone and maybe you sit on the floor to make it worse and you think about how bad the world has treated you and big warm tears start rolling down your face. God, this is wonderful, you know? But I drank for about 15 years, and for the first part of it, I drank sociably. I used alcohol. Alcohol did what I asked it to do. And it's a funny thing, and all of this is in retrospect, new person, but it's funny how three or four martinis would do what I called upon them to do. If I wanted to be friendly and kind of overbearing or kind of like a loudmouth, fun person, kind of, you know, the asshole of the party, three martinis would do that for me. If I wanted to be sophisticated and cool, three martinis, and I could be sophisticated and cool. If I wanted to be a great lover, three or four martinis made me imagine I was a great lover. If I wanted to drive fast or be sad, the same three martinis would let me and enable me to do in my mind and in society exactly what I wanted to do. It was the freedom. It was the vehicle that put me out there, that made me a part of the action, whether it was sad or joyous or business or whatever it was. It enabled me to talk to large groups. It enabled me to talk to girlfriends. It enabled me to participate in life. Thank God it did that, because I'd still be that 16-year-old wimp from high school, afraid to lead a group of two in silent meditation, you know? And I'll tell you a funny thing. If it still did the things for me that it used to do, I would still drink it. Because reality sucks sometimes, you know? If it would still take away fear and take away bill collectors and make me not worry about who's on the phone or who's at the door or what the boss wants to talk to me about or what my wife wants to discuss tonight or whatever it is, I'd still drink it. But sometime in 15 years, it quit doing the things that it used to do for me. And it did it very, very gradually without telling me that it wasn't going to do those things for me anymore. The book talks about crossing an invisible line, and I don't know if I crossed it when I was 16 and a skinny goof at that party. I don't know if I crossed it when I came to in jail in 1969. I don't know if I crossed it over a period of 5 years, gradually. But something happened. At the end of my drinking career, alcohol no longer did the magic. Alcohol no longer made the buzz happen. Alcohol no longer made me carefree and wonderful and funny and happy. The last part of my drinking was in neighborhood bars, those lonely gin mills, not fancy places like at the big hotels or the country clubs that I'd been at early on, but those neighborhood bars with a pool table and a jukebox, and just the locals came in, long bar with a back bar mirror, and I could sit there at that R stool at the end of the bar, you know, so nobody could get behind us, and you could check out the whole room at a glance. That kind of drinking where I just put whatever money I had, usually what was left of the rent money that I didn't pay, set it up there on the bar, and the bartender would set up the first one, then he knew, just keep the glass full until the money was gone. And I'd sit there and I'd look at myself in that mirror. I wonder what happened. How did I get to be 26, 27, 28 years old? How did I get to be this zero of a nothing, this unmanly, perverted, twisted, immoral thing that I am? Why am I sitting here spending the rent money? What happened to the barbecues and the parties and the country clubs and the business relationships and the camaraderie that I used to know? What happened to all the friends? What happened to the relationship I used to have with my wife? What happened to everything? How can I do this? How can I sit here and be nothing and have no plans for the future and just no idea what's going on around me? Give me another drink, bartender. Set him up one more time. And he knew I wasn't going to play the jukebox and roll the bar dice, and I wasn't going to hit on anybody's wife, and I wasn't going to wear the lampshade, and he knew I wouldn't throw up. He knew that I would sit there until the money was gone and I'd leave quietly. And that's what I did. I'd go out and hope there was a bottle under the seat of the car. And I'd go find that lonely place to finish that, maybe set till the sun came up, thinking, trying to figure it out. What happened? I was so bright and so intelligent and so many pats on the back and so many people expecting great things from me. Because when I got out of the service, I started in a banking career, and I was a special projects kind of guy. They'd give me hideous, terrible things that seemingly nobody else could accomplish, and I'd just tear into them and bring them the results 2 days before they expected them, and everybody go, oh, you're wonderful, and people talked great things about me, and it was, Jesus, the world was my apple, and it was all gone. Bankruptcy, leaving the industry in disgrace, blackballed from the industry. A wife I'd been married to a long time that couldn't tolerate me, she had that hideous, tolerant look in her face. It wasn't hate, it wasn't love, it was just, hi, yeah, good as it, yeah. Just nothing, just indifference, you know. A couple of kids that loved me but didn't know what to expect from me and didn't know whether daddy wanted to play tonight or whether they should go to the rooms. And just terrible. Hollow, lonely, and I had no idea how I got there and where I could go with it. I had been to church. I got so involved in the Lutheran church a few years before. They were going to make me leader of their young people for our church, which was a big church. And I was trying to seduce a 14-year-old girl in the church, you know? And I felt hideously dirty and perverted and twisted, and I quit the church. And I went to that church for a long time. I sat in the front row with my family all cleaned up. I was chairman of their building fund drive. You know, I was involved. I knew everybody in that church. And I left that church in my own disgrace. They never knew about it. I just quit one day. I'd been to therapy group and individual looking for answers to what I thought was just a problem marriage. And my therapist wanted to talk to me about my drinking. He gave me the 20 questions one time as I was leaving group therapy. You ever been to group therapy? What a waste of time group therapy is. Anyway, he gave me this 20 questions. He said, I don't know if you're a drunk or not, or if you're an alcoholic or not, but you talk a lot about drinking here in group. And here's a test you can take, I think, at some university put out, and I took this test down the bar. My bartender and I took the test. We had a good laugh. The next day, I called a staff meeting. I was still a big deal at the bank then. Called a staff meeting, got all my employees together. Had that test run off, made all my employees take the 20 questions. I did. Then I made a joke of it and threw it away. I came to in jail and up by San Francisco in February 1969. I came to, no big deal for this room, it was a big deal to me. I came to sitting there in my J.C. Penney suit, sitting on the floor of that jail cell, and I puked all over myself. I'd vomit all over my pants and my shoes, and my necktie had disappeared somewhere. My coat was wadded up in a ball over in the corner. And I'm sitting on the floor looking out through those bars trying to figure out, what the hell happened? Why am I in jail? I couldn't recall being arrested or booked. I didn't know what I had done, how long I'd been in their jail, how long I was going to be there. Nothing. Turns out it was the drunk tank, and they kicked me out at 6 o'clock in the morning. But that moment of clarity I had sometime in the middle of the night sitting on that floor sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe it was as a result of that goofy test. Maybe it was some barroom joke I'd heard that wasn't funny to me. I don't know. I drove into San Francisco and looked up AA. 166 Gary Street, San Francisco, fourth floor. And I went up there and I knocked on this plain door. It didn't say AA on it. It said Northern Inter-County Fellowship or something like that on the glass on the door, and I knocked on that door. Nobody answered, so I walked in. It was unlocked, and a big, long-legged, red-headed gal was sitting on the other side of the room, and she jumped up, hurtled the coffee table, stuck her hand out, smiled from ear to ear, and said, "Hi, I'm Alice. I'm alcoholic." You weirdo. Some other little chubby gal came out of a side office, come running over and said, "Hi, I'm Betty, I'm alcoholic." And they're standing there grinning at me, delighted that they're alcoholics. And they asked me, could they help me? And I muttered some nonsense. I don't remember what I said. They took me and introduced me to the manager of central office, a guy named Paul. Paul looked like Dr. Bob in that picture over there. He was old. God, he was old. And I sat in Paul's office for what seemed like a long time in retrospect. It could have been 45 minutes, but it seemed like it was 3 or 4 hours. We sat in there and we talked. And I kept asking him if I was an alcoholic, and every time I asked him about my drinking, he would tell me about his. I'd say, "If I just drink beer, can I be an alcoholic?" And he'd tell me how much beer he could drink or had drank. "If I just drink on weekends," he'd tell me how much he drank on weekends. I said, "Well, if he can't remember something, does that mean you're an alcoholic?" And shit, he was delighted about that. He told me about a 20-day blackout he was in. And he started volunteering stuff that's from the secret place. You know, that pit that you put stuff in from childhood that you never are going to tell anybody because you can't. And you take it to your grave because it's so dark, sordid, perverted, immoral, or nasty, that you put it in there and you guard it. I guarded it with facades and acting out and clowning and the ray and whatever I could summon up to keep people from seeing in there. And I would never have said anything from the secret place ever in my life. And this old poop was jerking stuff out of there, laying it on the desk for everybody to see, especially this total stranger. And the worse it was, the funnier he thought it was. He started just voluntarily, evidently there was a little lull in the conversation, and he started just telling me his story. Perverted, immoral, terrible, hideous things he had done. And the worse they were, the funnier he thought they were. And I looked at this guy, and he was either the most honest man I'd ever met or the sickest man I'd ever met. And I leaned towards sick and crazy because he had no reason. He was embarrassing me with these things he was telling me about. He sent me off with a pocket full of literature, and I went and found Alcoholics Anonymous the next day. I went to my first AA meeting and walked into this little room in this hospital cafeteria, about 150 sober members sitting in there waiting for the speaker to talk. And it was late, and they had read the chapters, and they were getting ready to start to introduce the speaker, and I walked in, and they found me a seat right out in the middle of the room between these two guys, and they were shaking hands and getting me a half a cup of coffee. And as I turned around to look up at the thing up in the front, they were introducing the speaker. They said, "Now we'll hear from Father Art." And a Catholic priest stood up and started walking for the microphone. I thought, this is church. This is church. They're going to sell me a Bible. We're going to turn our lives over to Jesus. And I ain't staying for that. I've been there, and I'm not staying for that. And my fanny was out of the chair about an inch or two. I'm trying to figure out, how could I get from the middle of this room back out that door I came into without disrupting the whole deal? And Father Art beat me. He got to the microphone and said, "I'm Father Art. I'm an alcoholic." I said, "The hell you are," and turned around and sat down and listened to this old poop. And this big, fat Catholic priest stood at my first AA meeting and told things out of the secret place. He told hideous, immoral, perverted, twisted, illegal things he had done as a priest. And I was just aghast. Everybody in the room was laughing their fannies off at him. My thought was, all we got to do is call a church and this boy's out of work. But he got me to doing what you were doing. All of these people around me were just rocking with laughter, and I found myself laughing. I picked up their enthusiasm and their joy. Then he got all sad and goofy, and all the women around me started crying. And some of the guys were crying. And I was feeling a tear, fighting back tears, because machos don't cry. And then he solved whatever it was or came through it and made everybody feel warm and fuzzy, and the meeting was over, and all these people were running up to have hugged the priest. The rest of them are running for me. Well, they're running up and stuffing phone numbers and literature and shit in my pocket, and I don't even want it. You know? These two guys sitting next to me finally rescued me. They took me captive, Glenn and Dale. Never will forget these two guys. They grabbed me, swung by the literature table, got me a big book, and they took me to a coffee shop. And they got me cornered in the back booth of the coffee shop. And they started telling their newcomer perverted, twisted, immoral things that they had done. You know, especially Glenn. Terrible, hideous, awful things he had done to his friends, his family, some farm animals. It was just awful. God damn. These guys would talk about stuff, and I was just trying to imagine doing that. I couldn't. And then they got into a can-you-top-this contest. Glenn would say something, some dastardly thing he had done, and Dale said, that ain't nothing. He'd tell something worse, you know? And Glenn said, well, but I forgot about this, and he'd tell something bad and worse and bad and worse. Awful. I made up things I hadn't even done. I couldn't believe this deal. They told me there's another meeting tomorrow night, and we'll pick you up. One of them did, and I said, great. I ran home, told my wife what I'd done. She was all happy. She pulled out literature she had hidden around the house for 2 years. And I went to a meeting the next night, and then the next night, and I was delighted to find out there was meetings every night because I wasn't having any fun at home. So I said, I'll meet you at the meeting. I'll go right from work, you know. And then, please, let's go to a coffee shop. I mean, I did not want to go home. And I fell in love with the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous from the start. From that day forward, I picked up the enthusiasm. I love this deal. I love this laughter, the hugging, the kissing, the goosing, the winks across the room, the meetings, the funny speakers, the smoke-filled rooms, the rotten coffee. I just love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like manure to rodeo. I was every place. I was at a meeting every night, with or without these guys, running the wheels off my car. We had caravan up to meetings in Santa Rosa and into San Francisco and all over the place. Having a ball, coffee shops, coffee clutches after the meeting, just laughing and arm in arm off into the AA sunset. Damn bite, it's going to be okay now. And I got drunk. I came out of a bar in San Francisco at closing time that I couldn't remember walking into. And I was that kind of drunk where my body was drunk and my mind was not. And I walked up Gary Street to this all-night coffee shop, and I sat in that coffee shop the rest of the night and argued with myself. Sat there and drank coffee and wondered, will they let me back in AA? Am I supposed to tell? Am I supposed to keep it a secret? Does everybody do this? Jesus, I didn't plan on trying to recreate the morning, what happened, because I found out I'd walked in there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon into this bar and came out at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I couldn't remember it. I couldn't remember buying my first drink or my last drink. I couldn't remember anything that happened in that bar. And I couldn't imagine why I would do it, because I thought about these rooms and people like you and the meetings I'd been to, and I loved AA. I loved everything about it. Finally, I got the courage. I called Glenn. Glenn had about 90 days, 95 days, something like that. Dale had 3 years. I mean, he knew everything, right? But yeah, I was a little afraid of him, so I called Glenn. Glenn came over to the house. And I demanded an explanation from Glenn. I was pissed. He sat down in my living room and I told him what happened, and he said, I'm sorry to hear that. I said, just how did I get drunk? He said, you drank whiskey. And I said, why would I do that? He said, you're alcoholic. And I wanted to strangle him. I was just crazy. I didn't understand why, how you can get drunk if you're in AA. And I was in AA up to my eyeballs. And I loved it. I really, truly loved it. I wasn't shining it. I wasn't ripping it off. I wasn't using it. I was in the middle of it. And he reached over on the coffee table and he picked up my big book. And he held it like it was the most prized possession he had ever picked up. And he said to me, "Jim, there's a big difference between fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Fellowship is those meetings that you go to. Fellowship is the coffee clutches and the conventions. Fellowship is all that hugging and kissing and grab-assing that you do at the meeting. That's fellowship. This is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in this big book. It's in these 12 steps in the first part of the book." I had read the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd had them read at me so many times. At one brief period of my sobriety, a brief period of sobriety in my early days, some goofy poop made me secretary of a small discussion meeting. And I took chapter 5 out of the meeting because we'd heard it read every damn night. It didn't make any sense to me to read this every stupid night. And I told him, I was taking it out, and we get a newcomer, we'll read it to him. But I'm not taking up time reading this nonsense. Anyway, I looked at those steps when I was new. And if you're new here today, maybe you've kind of thought this way, generally. I had been around enough, and in the next few months, I would hear circuit speakers. Real alcoholic circuit speakers. Well-dressed men and women who would show up and tell drinking stories that lasted 40 years. Hundreds of thousands of gallons of alcohol consumed. Some of these people had spilt more than I had drank. They had been around the world 3 times. They spoke 4 different languages. Some of them nobody else understood. They had broken every bone in their body at least twice. They'd been in jails in 3 different countries. They had been in multiple marriages, sometimes at the same time. They had chewed on their tongues in gutters, and they came to AA, and they showed up looking wonderful, and they told these terrible stories, and I sat back there, a cookie burner. I sat back there, a 28, 29, and 30-year-old wimp who didn't feel like he fit in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought this way, now not this specifically, but I thought this way. If you got a hangnail, you don't put a cast on your entire arm. And we had one of these old-time poops in our meeting. One of these guys' name was Tom. And he had done many of the things I just said. And my mind said, if old Tom needs 12 steps to obtain and maintain his sobriety, then 2 or 3 steps ought to do a wimp like me. It made sense to me. Half measures availed me nothing. But I tried my damnedest to stay sober on the first half of the first step, the last half of the last step, and a whole lot of 13th steps. And it didn't work. And I tried and tried and tried because I didn't feel that I had earned the necessity to take all of the steps. I had drank a mere 15 years, most of it social and okay drinking. Only the last couple of years was bad. I still had my wife. I still had a job. I still had a car. I still had kids. I still had things. And my mind must have said, no need to do all of those things. And what happened was I could not stay sober. And I would go to meetings, and sometimes when I was there for a while, they would let me be literature person, or let me lead, or let me be a 10-minute speaker, because I got over my fear of crowds and a microphone by taking effective and public speaking courses out in industry. And I spoke to large groups in my field, and they knew if they called on me, I wouldn't say, oh no, I couldn't. I couldn't talk tonight, thank you. Let somebody else talk. Shit, I'll talk. Yes, I'll talk. I'll read everything. You know, I'll read it twice. Let me talk. And they knew if they called on me, I would come up and participate, and I would quote and be clever and cute and be drunk next week, probably. But I would come in here, and then I would go out. I would come in, and I would go out. And I would come in. I did that for 2 years. I carried the disease instead of the message. For 2 years, I swung in and out of this brain dance, and I never did understand how and why I did it. I didn't understand what you were doing in here. I didn't understand why I had to take all of the steps. I didn't understand what old-timers were talking about. I didn't understand brown-nosed and newcomers that hung around with old-timers and got sponsors and did all of that regimented crap. I didn't understand anything. And what happens if you do that, and some of you unfortunately will, and some of us already have, is after a while nobody wants you. They don't want you down at the bar because you're not a regular, and they don't say, "Hi, Jim," when you walk in. They don't say the usual. They don't ask you to be on their dart team because you're inconsistent with them. And even drinkers have codes. And pretty soon down at, the serious ones do, you know. And down at Alcoholics Anonymous, you walk in there after your 18th slip, and they're not glad to see you. Those poops up in the front do not stop what they're doing. They say, "Hey, Jim, come here, come here. Look, look, you're going to go to the convention with us. You're going to the meeting tomorrow night. Gee, Clancy's going to be the speaker next Thursday," you know, all of this stuff that they did and they were going to do, and they quit talking to me about it. What would happen is I would walk into the clubhouse where I went to meetings, and they didn't stop and acknowledge me. They didn't turn around. They didn't greet me. They kept talking to their new newcomers and their friends, talking about what they did yesterday and what they're going to do tomorrow, and they were laughing and cutting up and having a good time. And I would walk up there among them, and I knew all of them, and I knew their families, small town AA. I'd been to places with them, panels and conventions and stuff at one time in my sobriety. And they just kept on talking to their friends and amongst themselves. And finally, I would make myself so obvious, they would turn around and they would say, "Oh, nice to see you." And they'd turn around and start laughing and talking to their friends again. I just want to kick them in the butt. Didn't they understand? I was as sober as a judge that day. I was as entitled to have this thing as they were. Why did they treat me like this, for Christ's sake? Am I some kind of a leper or something? Is there some secret you're not going to give me? How dare you act grandiose and better than me, you jerk? And I would sit in the back when I was at meetings. I would sit back there and wink at the girls and judge the speaker and time this son of a bitch, make sure he didn't go overtime. And I would just critique him and just be an awful person. One day over a period of time, I put 4 or 5 or 6 months of sobriety together by osmosis. You know, that kind of sobriety you get by hanging tight with the A&As and staying out of slippery places. That kind of sobriety you get just by going to meetings. You walk around the meetings with your fists doubled up till you're white to your elbows, get your teeth locked together. People say, "How are you?" You say, "Fine!" You know? That kind of, just can't stand this another second. One day in January 1971, I couldn't handle it for another 8 minutes. I had to kill something or drink. I could have surrendered, but I didn't know that was an option. I had no idea that I had not surrendered. I thought I had been in those meetings and been sincere and tried everything. And I had tried nothing. I had not surrendered an inch. And I didn't know that. When you knew, you don't know that. What happened was that day in January, I decided to have a little drink before lunch. And I came to a week later in Honolulu, Hawaii. And I didn't know where I was. One of them kind of drugs where you look out through the Venetian blinds and try to figure it out. A lot of palm trees here. Kind of a deal where you want to go out and buy a newspaper to find out what the date is, what town you're in, stuff like that. But I was sick, and I was naked, and I was puking and excrementing and jackknifing around this broken glass and soiled clothes, hideous little room with stone soap and Waikiki Beach. Dying. Just dying. Just crazy, just bizarre, just almost dead, and I didn't know how it got me. And I came to in that little room January the 18th of 1971, and something had happened. Somehow, without my knowledge, without my request, I had surrendered. What had happened, and I didn't know it for some time later, is I had conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, and that I had a disease called alcoholism, and that stopping drinking is but the tip of the iceberg. It's the start of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came back to AA in that same clubhouse where I resented all of those fools and the weight and all of the stuff that they did, and I got a sponsor. And the sponsor got me a big book and started me on the program of recovery to give me freedom from bondage of self, not just stop drinking. I found out in the next few years that putting the plug in the jug makes me crazier than hell. If not drinking was the answer, then I would get better when I don't drink, as my sponsor said. if not drinking was the answer, I would feel good when I'm not drinking. And I feel terrible when I'm not drinking. I feel frightened and insecure, and I feel like a wimp, and I feel like an unmanly, unsuccessful person when I'm not drinking. And when I drink, I feel grandiose and self-sufficient and successful and perfect. And I look down on people. And I came to this deal, and I got this sponsor, and he took me into the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he started dictating things for me to do, actions for me to do that were not in the big book. He got in my face, started screaming at me and telling me to go to meetings every night of the week. 7 nights of the week, you're going to be in a meeting. That's not in the big book. I went home and looked for it. He made me sit in the same seat at every meeting that I went to. I asked him one day very timidly, why do I have to do that? He said, so I can find you. Shut up. You know? I had to call him every day. It doesn't say that in the big book. I had to do all sorts of nonsense he had learned at some sponsor school someplace. You know? And what happened is, primarily from the fear of him kicking my butt, I stayed sober. And I read the big book, and I carried the message as best I could, and I actively participated in my own sobriety. And then I got a new sponsor who was a 12-stepper, one of these step guys and God guys. And he took me through all of the steps and made me write most of them, including my inventory, which I read to him. And I started growing up from the inside out. And I didn't know that was happening. All I know is that I had moved to the front lines of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had moved up with the winners. And I'd gotten away from the guys that are chit-chatting during the readings and wandering around the room and making fun and laughing and talking during the speakers and during the readings of Chapter 5 and the traditions. I'd gotten up with the people who wanted this thing with all of their hearts, and the guys who were enjoying it, the guys who were free, the guys who were changing, the guys who were happy, learning something about sobriety, the guys who were in book study meetings and step study meetings that meant something. And I got into those meetings. I started learning about this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started learning about me, and I didn't know that. And it started just coming to me in waves, things that I was unaware of about me, that I can fail and then try again and fail and try again. And failure is just failure. It doesn't mean that I'm a no-good son of a bitch. It just means I tried something and I couldn't do it. And I could try again. That I had to get up and I had to dust myself off and keep going for it. And I made a lot of mistakes when I was new in AA. I still liked the girls an awful lot, and I needed that sexual validation outside of my marriage so badly, I suppose, that I couldn't stop doing that. And I borrowed money that I couldn't pay back, and I did grandiose things, and I was a jerk sometimes. But other times I worked on conventions as an usher, and I worked in general service work for a little bit, and I helped the central office get started and helped them find used furniture to furnish our first central office in that little town. I helped pay for the phone bill a couple of times, and I started carrying the message into joints and road camps and prisons and hospitals and things like that, and getting those feelings that you get when you're leaving that joint, and those convicts or those inmates or those sick people in those hospitals look at you with a tear in their eye and say, thanks for bringing me something. And I got those warm feelings, and I started building relationships with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know that I would come to love you more than my own family. I didn't know that I would come to have a bond with a guy that I sponsor stronger than the bond that I had with my own brother and sister. I didn't know that I would cry at funerals of people in Alcoholics Anonymous more than I cried at my own parents' funeral. I didn't know that you would give me magic, that you would give me wonderfulness, you would give me my manhood as a result of these silly things in this funny book. I didn't know any of that would happen. I came here and started doing these things because I hurt, because I was afraid, because I didn't want to fail again, because I didn't want what I had. Everything I had was stacked up and it was right there. All of my efforts amounted to zero. All of my intelligence, all of my brightness, all of my manliness was a hollow pervert standing here undressed. And I gave myself to these sponsors, these unprofessional people. One of them was a lion cowboy, and the other one was an ex-convict. And the ex-convict gave me a life that the psychiatrist and the priest couldn't give me. The sponsor said for me to do things, and I did them because of my love for him, and I couldn't do that for my own wife. I treated newcomers better than I treated my own kids. And I stayed here, and I participated in my recovery by a desire of my own most of the time, fear of a sponsor, and peer pressure from goofs like you. A lot of times I would have gotten drunk, but damn it, I wouldn't give so-and-so the pleasure of seeing me drunk. You know? And reality happened, and pain happened, and hideous things befell me, as it befalls all of us in sobriety. When you don't have the booze to push it back and round it off, people look at you funny on the freeway and you get suicidal and homicidal. You know? And I had terrible things. I got my car repossessed when I was 6 years sober. Jesus, that was embarrassing, you know? When I got my car repossessed, my sponsor came down and picked me up at the corner of 19th and Chester in this town. Took me down to the coffee shop. Put me back together. I said, Jesus, Joe, I'm so ashamed and humiliated. What'll I ever do about this? He said, go to the meeting tonight and tell them I repossessed your car. I said, I can't do that, Joe. Jesus, I'm an example for the new people. What kind of an example is that? I go down and tell all these new people my car got repossessed. He said, why don't you go down there and tell them you borrowed the car, you borrowed the down payment from one bank, financed the car by lying on a credit application at the other bank, you got a car you didn't need, you couldn't afford to impress us, and we didn't need impressing. Why don't you go tell them that? We had this speaker meeting on Friday night and had voluntary participation before the meeting. He said, just go down there and raise your hand. I said, okay, fine. I went down there and I raised my hand about this high. But he had tipped somebody off, I guess. Yes, Jim, what would you like to talk about? And you did that. You laughed at me. All of you who had had repossessions came up and told me about it. We all had a good laugh. Somebody loaned me a car and life went on. You know? Trouble with kids. Divorced my wife after 23 years of a non-marriage. 23 years where she tried to participate in the marriage and I didn't. 23 years where I lived a lie and I finally grew up enough I couldn't do that anymore. I just couldn't do it and I had to call it off. Shattered the family, shattered her, confused the kids, divided the AAs right down the middle, her side, my side, you know. Walked through it with some kind of dignity and the pain was horrendous. And the embarrassment was horrendous and the confusion and the hurt that goes along with a divorce was all over me. And I came to meeting and I shared my pain and my agony and you held me together and you told me it's all right. Just come on, do this and let's give this goofy newcomer a ride home. Maybe he'll puke, you know, and be fun, you know. This stuff, you know. Get my mind off of it. I would take horrendous problems to my sponsor and he'd laugh in my face. I called Clancy one time a few years ago. He was sponsoring me long distance and I lived about 120 miles away and I called him with a unsurmountable problem. I mean, this was a problem of such magnitude, it needed three sponsors. It just was just, I only have one sponsor, but it was just a terrible, complicated, intricate, unsolvable situation. And I called him up and I read off this scenario to him, and he said to me, Jim, I've seen a lot of guys make it through this kind of a situation, but I don't think you can. Click. About a minute later, when I got through crying, I began to laugh because the problem, and I still can't remember what it was to this day, the problem was created and imagined by me and didn't exist. My sponsors have saved my bacon time and time and time again, and when they were unavailable, I confided to my peer group and other people in the group, and they shared with me on one-on-ones, and we went on. And it's been good. It's been wonderful. Most of the time. If it was painful all of the time, this room would be empty. Because I know where the solution is. I know where the pain reliever is. I know exactly how to find it, and I got the money in my pocket to buy the first few. But Alcoholics Anonymous somehow has some kind of a magic and a chemistry in these confusing 12 steps that don't seem to apply to anything that's happening on an ongoing daily basis. I have looked at those 12 steps many times for what do you do when you got a jerk for a boss? What do you do when your girlfriend calls the house all the time? You know? What do you do when you get fired? What do you do when it's too hot to go out and make those sales calls? What do you do when you're still a pervert? Where does it say in here that you can't go to dirty movies anymore? Where do you find the answers to these things? When do you feel like a man? I would look and look and look and look in the 12 and 12 and all of these things, looking for solutions, looking for definite answers to my living problems. And they were all answered in time. Because what the 12 steps did is they reached down inside of me and brought me kicking and screaming into manhood. And I never thought I could do that. I never thought the wimp would ever stand up and be a man. But the 12 steps requested that I look at me for the problem. That I concede that I am the main problem in my life. That I ask that a power greater than myself help me. I give my life to that power. I look at me for my dirty laundry. I share that dirty laundry with others. I take all of the stuff that's fun, and I know it's just the fun stuff, and ask God to remove it from my life. I write down on paper people that I hurt and that hurt me, and go around and pay back money to people who forgot I borrowed it from them, who forgot I even exist, and I got to go find them and make it right somehow. I got to find this God. I got to continue to fail and say I have failed and I hurt somebody, or I let somebody down and I screwed up, I lied, I stole today. I got to keep admitting it every time I screw up. I got to keep looking for this God in AA and in church and in the Bible and in whatever things I can do to seek Him and get Him in my life. And if I do all of that, I can carry this message to new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened is, a man appeared without my knowledge or request. A man showed up. Because as a result of doing those things, I found different values for my life. I found different standards to live by and a different measure of a man. I thought men were marines. I thought men had beards and smoked cigars and drank whiskey and never cried and used women and murdered Bambi every year, you know? I thought men were macho and men were tough, and you had to give me a man. You had to tell me a man does what he says he's going to do. A man, it doesn't matter how he feels, only matters what he does. It doesn't matter if I feel like having an affair. It only matters if I do it. It only matters if I'm honest with the people who trust me and total strangers. It only matters that if I don't act grandiose, I won't have to defend it. It only matters that if I say I'm going to do this, I do that. It only matters that I am what I say that I am and nothing more. I don't picture myself to be bigger or better than I am. I talk about my weaknesses and my failings, and I don't know if I can do that, but I'll try. And then I have to go and try. And if I can't do it, I've got to admit that. And suddenly, a man stood up. And I could lay my head on my pillow, and I could sleep all night and not have to worry about it. A few years ago, I married my lovely bride, Rita, who I watched come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw her the day she got sober, and I was introduced to her by a big guy who had been around for a little while, and it was during my truth stage, where everybody got truth, whether they wanted it or not. And this big guy named Carl said, "Hi, Jim, say hi to Rita, she's new." And I looked at this poor girl, who was dressed rather bizarrely, and I said, "Hi, Rita, you're too fat to dress like that." I don't know why she didn't like me, I was trying to help her. I used to follow this poor girl around meetings and pester at her and get in her face. As I did, she thought I was picking on her. I did to everybody. When I had truth, man, everybody got it. When I had the answers, I gave them to everybody. When I was God, I let everybody know about that. And when I was a wimp, I shared that too. And I went through all of those phases. A few years ago, Rita and I fell in love. And right after my divorce, we got married. And we have a good, solid AA relationship. She'll be participating in this convention tomorrow night. And I love this woman, and I'm faithful to her. I love the friends that I have made here. I love this thing and this God that I found here that supports this movement. I love these meetings of people like you all across this country for the thing that you have given me, which I thought was don't drink.
And what it was freedom from the bondages of self. The seven deadly sins, the prisons that I put me in, you didn't put me in, the sheriff didn't put me in, the prison of lust, and the prison of greed, the prison of envy, and the prison of sloth and laziness, the prison of pride that wouldn't allow me to cry, wouldn't allow me to fail, wouldn't allow me to share my shortcomings with people. And most of the time today, you've given me freedom from those prisons by not drinking, which is first, and by showing up at these meetings and doing these things, and coming to Omaha, Nebraska, to the hog calling contest, and sharing it with you. And for that, I'm grateful. Thank you.